you do not help fund the resistance. You sit comfortably. You consume. You watch. You wait for others to fight the battle for you. The dark side has you firmly in its grasp. Every day, you remain on the sidelines. My power grows stronger. Continue believing. Someone else will save the galaxy. It pleases me greatly.
The trial of Shiloh Hendricks, who faces a conviction of disorderly conduct for calling a black child a racial slur at a Rochester park in April 2025.
He said, say it. Do you have the balls to say it again? Say it again. Say the N-word. And he actually says the full word. And then Right. He says the N-word a couple times. And he says, I bet you won't say it again.
Okay, why don't you have the balls to say it right now again?
Obviously, Shiloh obliged his request, and she said it. And so she was found guilty for her conduct towards the man following her through the park as she was trying to leave with the child on her hip.
Are you about to hit him? You chase him here?
He took my son's stuff.
As she was leaving the park the entire time in that video, you can see she's walking away, walking to leave the park. So that's what the jury found her guilty of.
Man, these Somalis really got a lot of nerve. I want to make it very clear. We're not talking about foundational black Americans here. These are people that just got here, fresh off the boat, East African, not West African, literally Muslim slave traders. Throw that up. So this is on the record true. Nobody knows this. Nobody talks about this. But these are the people that can assimilate into our country the best. The people with an insane slave trade history, known for being coastal slave traders, known for being pirates as well. I mean, maybe the boomers like Pirates of the Caribbean a little too much, and they think it's kind of like that over there or something or whatever. But I know I won't ever be voting for any of this mass immigration. But, you know, I did kind of because I voted for Trump and he didn't do anything about it. So,
yeah, these are sub-Saharan Africans. They're known for their scamming. And even in this case, there was additional fraud that was revealed. The state's main witness, Shire Jamali, who was the father of the child, lied on the stand multiple times. He perjured himself multiple times, committed perjury. It was a complete clown show. No one could believe it. They had two translators who were switching out every 30 minutes to translate everything he said. And it was just total confusion. The jury just was looking on in disbelief as he was saying these things. He would just contradict himself on every other word.
How did they reach the guilty verdict then? And what was the charge?
So the only person that was their main witness was the father of the child. So Shiloh's defense attorney thoroughly discredited his testimony because he had claimed that, you know, he thought Shiloh was going to attack his son when she was going to retrieve the item that was stolen from her. The kid who was, the father says, nine years old, who wears an ankle monitor, by the way, and police installed, because the child has to be held by the hand at all times or he will escape and run off. The father testified that he would run off 2 to 3 times per day. So he has a police installed tracking device on this kid.
She was acquitted about the child. She's convicted on the count involving the cameraman, who they never called to testify. Keep this in mind. They never called the cameraman to testify. This judge prohibited us from telling the jury that Shire Jamali had a GoFundMe page, $340,000. He testified that it was done in May last year. Done. That's not true. There's a link on the bottom of the page that goes to another open account. My investigator hit the link last night, donated $10. It's open. You can donate right now. You can donate right now to Shire Jamali's GoFundMe page right now. It's open. He testified under oath and perjured himself. He perjured himself over and over and over and over again. This was without any stretch of the imagination. It was like I was fighting the prosecutor and the judge. It was like I'm taking on two parties at the same time. The judge and the prosecutor. It was very bizarre. Very bizarre.
So then she goes back. She grabs her kid, goes to leave, and another Somali man shows up. He's holding the phone, and that's where the recording starts that you see in the viral video. This Somali man is not related to the father or the child.
And it's pretty cool. The boomers, you know, we are the world. They invited all these people in here. It's pretty.
American dream and your God-given freedom. We're live on alexjoneslive.com, and if you want to fight, you've got one. Yeah! Yeah!
You're watching The War Room with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch it live right now on X.com. Annihilate.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon. It is the 28th of July, 2026. We got a big show for you, of course. The late Lindsey Graham, the late Senator Lindsey Graham, is being laid to rest today, and we're getting some footage from his funeral. Benjamin Netanyahu is in town. Volodymyr Zelensky is in town. It's a big villain confab in Washington, D.C., and we'll bring you some clips from that. In fact, let's go ahead and start with a clip from that. We'll start with the eulogy delivered by Sean Hannity. Clip 20, this is Sean Hannity on Lindsey Graham during his funeral delivering a eulogy. Let's see what the man says as we pay respect to one of the most dedicated mongers of war the world has ever seen. Let's watch.
I see Prime Minister Netanyahu is here. Mr. Prime Minister, you too have been a dear friend of mine for 30 years. It's an honor to have you. And Lindsey would have been blown away that you took this long journey with your beautiful bride to be here today. He loved you. He loved the state of Israel. He loved the people of Israel. Under your leadership, Israel has been one of America's most consistent and loyal allies. He was never shy to say it to the day he passed. And just as President Trump has been Israel's strongest friend in the history of the White House, you know, the two partners aligned together. Lindsey was that friend to Israel in the United States Senate, as long as I've known this man. Lindsey, he was often unfairly characterized as a warmonger. I've heard that false criticism a lot. It's not true.
Who would say such a thing?
The truth was the opposite. Lindsey desperately wanted and talked to the president about a lasting peace in the Middle East. He wanted every region, every country in the region on that path to peace. That was Lindsey's dream. If people would only listen to what he had been saying.
Okay, bro. Whatever you say, Sean. He loved peace. Really? Did he know that? You know, honestly, it is genuinely kind of sad. Like, on a humanitarian perspective, I mean, just somebody's funeral where typically you would hear about their accomplishments in life, the families they created, the impact that they had. It's literally all warmonger neocons talking about how good Lindsey Graham was at whipping up war, but don't call him a warmonger because he loved peace. He just saw peace as, I guess, somewhere at the end of the line. Like, you bomb enough people, you kill enough people, I'm sure peace will arrive. That had to have been the theory, because I didn't hear him talk a lot about peace. I heard him talk a lot about war. Like, maybe it'd be interesting, I don't know if we have the video in there today, but from yesterday, perhaps the day before, we had Lindsey Graham from a documentary, sort of giddy and happy and giggling about how excited he was for the war in Iran. Not for the prospect of peace. That's not, no, this was the ending of a very long piece he was absolutely ecstatic about and overjoyed with. The thing is, it's not just that his life was given to spreading the cause of Israeli domination around the world. He literally died for the cause. I don't know if people understand that. Well, if you take the official story, okay, he may very well have been killed in a drone strike in Ukraine. For all we know, it was a closed casket. We didn't get a lot of information from that. But, like, I have a family friend who very nearly died of the same thing Lindsey Graham did. And it turns out if you catch it early, if you're like, what happened to my family friend is he was already at the doctor, made a complaint about something. They discovered that he had this pulmonism or whatever it's called that Lindsey Graham died from. And on the day Lindsey Graham died, he was supposed to go to the doctor, but decided that he just had to go on TV. He couldn't miss, I believe it was a Meet the Press interview, because he just had to one last time advocate for war. And it's, I mean, you talk about Senator Bloodfeast. There's this classic meme of Senator Bloodfeast. And it, I mean, on the meme, it's like, you know, I don't want to die. God, let's just bomb Iran one more time before I go. And, you know, that was Lindsey Graham. Like, in a very real way, this is my eulogy for Lindsey Graham. It would just be a big picture of Senator Bloodfeast. If the crew can find an image of Senator Bloodfeast, or perhaps we can, I don't know if we can pull in Reese. One time made an animation of Senator Bloodfeast that was very accurate. Yeah, there he is. Yeah, Senator Bloodfeast of Iowa, 118 years old. Please, God, let's nuke Iran. Nothing else matters. I'll do anything, please. I just want to see burning flesh one last time before I die. And he's a respectable bipartisan, of course. Of course, just like Lindsey Graham. So, like, genuinely, he genuinely spent his life advocating for whatever the hell is going on in the Middle East right now. You know, the disaster, you know, the horrible quagmire disaster that we're now in again in the Middle East again. This was his life's work. This was his legend. Like, that's what it is. And I just want, is it worth it? Is it worth it? Like, which would you rather have? Would you rather have wanted war criminals, you know, talking about how what a wonderful servant you were? Would you rather have some of the most wicked and evil warmongers on the face of the planet give eulogies about how loyal you were to them? Would you rather have, like, I don't know, children, grandchildren, a family, people who genuinely know and love you? I mean, it's just, if it was up to me, I just wonder what choices Lindsey Graham would make if he could go back in time. He'd probably make exactly the same ones, to be honest with you. I don't want to speak ill of the dead, not least which on his funeral day, but I find it incredibly annoying every time a politician dies and they get this state funeral type service. Y'all remember when George H.W. Bush died? It was like a month of mourning. He like traveled across the country and there was a new ceremony at every stop. Same thing with John McCain, same thing with Lindsey Graham. And it's just like, it's like we have these forms that are purpose built for glory. It's like somebody who is, you know, genuinely glorious deserves this sort of glorious sending off. But it's like, how far we've fallen. I guess in a word, you could say how far we have fallen. Just footage of Donald Trump giving Lindsey's coffin a little love tap. That's one of the videos that's come out. Netanyahu, of course, is in town meeting with President Trump. Apparently they did meet. And unfortunately for all of us, Benjamin Netanyahu came out saying it was a wonderful conversation. And that they agree on everything. So that, again, portends absolute disaster in the very near future. It's also, you know, at this point, like whether it's the Iran war or just anything with Trump, you know, for a while, it's been the situation that you can kind of ignore what he says because it is clearly completely unmoored from reality. And this is a practically daily occurrence now. I mean, there was an example today. On Drudge headline saying, you know, Iranians begging to talk. Meanwhile, you've got a story from the Iranian spokesperson saying, no, we're not begging to talk. That's ridiculous. Like literally every time Trump is like, they're begging to talk, there's an immediate countermanding of that from the people involved. Like, no, we never said that. Trump is lying to you. So at a certain point, you kind of go, all right, Trump is just sort of saying stuff. Kind of doesn't matter. He's saying that they're working for peace. He bombs the diplomats. But it's so inconsistent. It's not like you can believe the opposite. It just is unmoored. It just is not related to what's actually going on in reality at all. I'd say you have to watch their actions, but even their actions seem incomprehensible and convoluted and inconsistent. Let's go to clip number five here. This is President Trump just hours before Benjamin Netanyahu was slated to meet him in Washington, D.C. Let's watch.
I don't need Bibi to tell me that. Bibi's telling me that because he wants me to stay involved. I mean, right. I don't necessarily. We have the finest, because of Space Force, we have the greatest cameras in the world focused on. We know exactly what's going on. But no, I heard Bibi announce that. I said, why don't you just tell it to me? Why do you have to announce it to the world? I know exactly what's going on at Pickaxe. It's not a big problem. We took out their nuclear sites, and we'll have to take out Pickaxe if we don't make a deal. If we don't make a deal, we'll take it out very easily.
So you're talking about Pickaxe Mountain, which is different than the Fordo site, which we already destroyed, and we destroyed their nuclear material, although they do still have their nuclear material, and it's not, you know, actually destroyed, and Fordo wasn't actually the site. That's dangerous. It's this Pickaxe Mountain one. So everything else we told you before, forget about that. We were lying. Are bad. But now, definitely, we'll do this. It'll be super simple. I mean, I know they did try to do that already previously, and it ended up with a hastily arranged rescue mission and the deployment of ghost murmur technology to try to save the people who crashed. I believe that was an attempt to extricate the nuclear material. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's just, I guess, this is what I'm saying. It's like impossible to get your hands around anything. That was Donald Trump basically saying Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't tell me what to do. And he seemed kind of mad that Netanyahu went to the public and the media on this. Netanyahu, I really got to, like, who is this guy? You really got to wonder who the hell this guy is. I just watched a documentary, like a biography of Netanyahu, and it doesn't make any sense. I'm just going to tell you right now, his rise is completely baffling. And some things that I don't know. The one thing you have to understand, like, Benjamin Netanyahu himself is largely responsible for how we use the word terrorism. In this documentary, I should probably just find the clips, but it was totally fascinating because it was talking about how previously what we would consider terrorist acts, like airplane hijackings, were almost always treated as not terrorism, but acts of insurgency. And there's an example of, like, Walter Cronkite reporting on an early example of Palestinian, what we would call terrorism, hijacking a plane. And the way that Walter Cronkite covers it is not these horrible anti-human terrorists have taken hostages because they're evil and they're so evil and bad. It was these Palestinian, you know, insurgency members forced the matter that diplomatic circles had heretofore ignored, right? They, in an act of desperation, they took this act because they have, you know, political demands that they could not achieve, could not be listened to. They had to do something. They took a plane full of people hostage. And when you think about it that way, as terrorism, as acts of insurgency, whether it's legitimate or not, it's not saying one way or the other, but it at least gives some sort of credence to the action. And especially if you think about, like, post-World War II, a time when, you know, governments were murdering civilians all over the place at a massive rate. You know, you can't exactly say, well, it's terrorism because they targeted civilians. It's like, well, every military in the world targets civilians and did target civilians to an even greater degree back then. And so Benjamin Netanyahu, who, by the way, again, grew up in Philadelphia, spent his 20s and 30s working as, like, he studied to be an architect at MIT, and then he somehow got his master's degree in, like, a single year. Very sort of suspicious rise. And that was his power. His power was that he was American and that he could sell the idea of terrorism to Americans. So then he goes back to Israel and he creates something called the Jonathan Institute, I believe is what it's called, or the Jonathan Project, something like that. And the whole point of this institute was to expand the common vernacular usage of terrorism and to expand the idea of terrorism and to frame terrorism as a concept, as as being a unique almost philosophy and ideology, when in reality and previously it's always seen as what it was, a tactic militarily used, right, to cause terror. And you know, even in World War One, the German army, you know, had strategies. They didn't call it terror, but they called it something else. They called it like, I can't remember exactly the exact word for it, but it was the same idea, right? You target civilians in order to basically cow them into submission. This is a sort of a regular strategy. So the point is that slowly over time, over decades, like starting around the, you know, late 70s, maybe mid 80s, all the way up to the mid 90s, there was this concerted effort to portray the opponents of Israel as irredeemable enemies of mankind. Obviously, this has been incredibly effective because it completely removes any actual reason the terrorism is happening. If you label terrorism as just this senseless, inhuman expression of hate that can't be reasoned with and doesn't have a cause or a purpose, then, you know, when you have suicide bombers attacking Israel, then that's what it is. It's these crazy people who are just blowing up Israelis for no reason. If instead you say, well, this was a terroristic action by an insurgency group who has demands or who has grievances because of the attacks that they've been under, suddenly it's not as black and white. Suddenly it's not crazy, evil, anti-civilizational people attacking decent, innocent people. It's like, well, actually, this is a wider conflict. This is any terrorism that takes place there is absolutely a response to the actions of Israel in the first place. So by I don't know if I'm getting it across here as clearly as I could, but this is Netanyahu's contribution to the world. Basically, so he has spent his whole life pushing this idea that terrorism is a unique expression that can't be reasoned with, has no strategic purpose. And so therefore, they're always and exclusively the bad guys, and there's never a reason to even consider why they might be doing it. It's led us to the situation where we're in now, where you can't even try to find a solution to the conflict because you're seen as being sympathetic to the devil, the terror, right? And you just think about the sort of influence that Netanyahu has had, and the fact that Yitzhak Rabin helped carry out the Oslo Accords and then was murdered for it. And going back, you know, Netanyahu was leading, international terrorism challenge and response. And of course, this was sort of baked into the Cold War aspect too, where Americans were very much primed to be like, this is civilization versus communism, civilization versus terrorism. It was very easy to fit it into that dichotomy view. And now they're trying to do that with anti-Semitism, essentially. They're trying to basically claim that any attempt to come to a reasonable conclusion, which absolutely has to involve, you know, Israel taking account for its misdeeds as well as the terrorists taking account for its misdeeds. But when you set it up in this paradigm where the terrorists are irredeemably evil, then you can't ever make an argument that could lead to any sort of peace. So Benjamin Netanyahu in the 90s after the Oslo Accords is leading these marches where people have signs that are like, kill the prime minister, and like chanting things like that, to the point where Mossad apparently pulled Benjamin Netanyahu aside and was like, hey, you got to tamp down your rhetoric because there actually are a lot of plots to kill Yitzhak Rabin, and we think you're stoking the fires. Of course, he didn't stop. He continued to stoke the fires very aggressively and deliberately, and Yitzhak Rabin was murdered. And so as you look back through history, it's like, okay, I don't actually think it's all that complicated. When I look back in history, I see a pretty clear-cut example of like a foreign population going to the promised land, going to the Middle East and the Holy Land, imposing themselves by force, refusing to even attempt like peaceful integration, but instead just like immediately start on trying to ethnically cleanse the natives there. Like, it seems pretty clear cut to me. But let's just, for the sake of argument, it can be a little bit, you know, hey, the Israelis did stuff, but the Arabs did stuff too. There's a little back and forth. It is a, you know, it's a complicated history. Let's pretend it's a complicated history in Israel. Still, up until the Oslo Accords, you know, you still had something like 70% of the Israeli population believing that there could be a peaceable, possibly two-state solution following the Oslo Accords. Both the Arabs and the Israeli extremists on either side, you know, get into the conflict. The whole thing collapses. There's never been really anything even approaching that level of, you know, top level negotiation. Yeah, that was his brother who was killed. The Jonathan Institute, Netanyahu's father, commented in 1979 that Yoni would have been disappointed with the West's reaction against terrorism. He would, I think, express great dismay and concern at the weakness and indecision displayed by some democracies towards this phenomenon. He said he felt that there are principles that must be upheld if civilization itself is to survive. So this is what I want to point out. When they redefine words like terrorism or anti-Semitism to, instead of describe the thing they were supposed to describe, like anti-Semitism is supposed to be, you know, some sort of unwarranted and biased and discriminatory hatred of Jews for no reason, just like terrorism, it's now seen as just senseless, barbarous attacks against civilization by uncivilized people who don't have legitimate grievances or concerns, can't be reasoned with. It makes it impossible to actually achieve peace. It actually makes even approaching the subject dangerous. And so these are the main like influences Netanyahu has had over the geopolitical world, is that creating this idea of terrorism as a uniquely evil and unreasonable reaction to certain things or to anything. In fact, it takes it out of the realm of being a reaction to anything and makes it just a thing on its own. Because again, if you were to say why, I mean, that question sort of, you know, destroys the whole paradigm, the whole construct, right? These Palestinians, you know, they raided on October 7th, they went in and they killed all these people, they took hostages. And it's like, oh my God, that's horrible. Why? Why did they do that? But why did they do that though? Why did they think they needed to do that? From their perspective, you don't have to agree with it, but they did have a reason, didn't they? They did have things they were trying to achieve. They did have hurts they were trying to wreak revenge for. I mean, if you just take that out and you don't pay attention to whatever they say, how are you possibly going to come to a place where those types of attacks don't happen anymore? So it's redefining terrorism. But the other thing is bringing the American Jewish population mainly are like his constituency. That's who influences. Like before, Yitzhak Rabin, dude had an Israeli accent. He didn't sound American. Netanyahu sounds American. We'll be right back. I'll explain it more.
And a microscopic tag be implanted in a person's body to track his every movement. There's actual discussion about that.
And often they're things you don't know what to do with. UBOs, they're called unidentified bright objects.
Can brain scans be used to determine whether a person is inclined toward criminality or violent behavior?
Who's got the brain that's going to be most susceptible to a particular kind of manipulation?
So the point is, they've been obsessed with this. It's going on. The COVID shots implanted the matrix, graphene oxide to grow. It's now being scanned. It's now being read. They were putting chips in the troops 30 years ago. The revolution's already here, is what you're saying, Jesse Beltran.
These are just chips on a size that you can no longer see. They're nano size. One's 2,000 times the width of a human hair. The graphene oxide, the silicon-based materials that have been in, we know for a fact that they were in the mRNA. We know that Dr. Ido Bachelet signed a contract with Pfizer in 2015 when he did that TEDMed talk with a trillion robots in a 1cc syringe, and how he teaches his students how to, once they're in a host, how to control them with RF emissions.
And you heard Collins saying 21 years ago that, oh yeah, when we're doing scans, we find all these chips, these bright objects, ha ha ha, wonder who put them there. But as you said, you've been doing this 20 years, and about 10 years ago, you began to go away, not seeing chips anymore, but just liquid emulsion nanotech. Here you are 6 months ago or more, scanning me. Let's go to Alex Jones getting scanned.
So if you put that camera in there, you see how it says probably silicone? That means it's an electronic component. And it's not unusual to find that in the posterior ear area.
So wait, I got a higher reading than him?
No, his was higher than yours.
Okay,
yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, but you did get a positive reading there. So you are getting the you know, base of the neck is what we typically see. Scapula area. What we're finding is after post-COVID, this is very typical. We're completely bombarded by this stuff.
From your own research, there are compounds naturally in nature that just do absolutely incredible things that will draw out these type of things. But you guys have come up with one with scientists that adds these special sea minerals in that then even drags it out even more. And so I have been taking this, the dreams I've had, my skin, my health, what it's done is absolutely insane. Get masterpiece.com. Matt Hazen, tell us what this does, and people can get 10% off when they follow the URL, getmasterpiece.com, or use promo code Alex when you're there on the site, because this is really special.
Zeolite is an incredible mineral that is known as what's called the master binder. And what that means is it's known to pick up every type of forever chemical, toxin, toxic heavy metal there is, including fluoride. So when you see charcoal or carbon or clays for binders, you don't see that they will pick up fluoride. Zeolite's different. Zeolite also gets the fluoride. That's a very big deal. It is great at removing these environmental toxins from our body. Masterpiece is the highest grade sea mineral plasma solution. It is basically isotonic, the same mineral composition as your blood plasma. So the sea minerals are being carried in by the nanometer, sub-nanometer size clinoptilolite zeolite. And once the toxin hits the zeolite, it releases and displaces the mineral. People don't feel bad. There's no normal detoxing reaction.
Everybody needs to go to getmasterpiece.com. You get 10% off by using that URL automatically when you go. There's promo code Alex as well. Getmasterpiece.com.
All right, welcome back, folks. This is War Room on AlexJonesLive.com, the Alex Jones Network. I'm your host, Harrison Smith. Some interesting stories today. If you were watching the Alex Jones Show yesterday, I was interviewing Michael Yon. He was coming to us live from Japan, and in the middle of one of his answers, he stopped, and he's like, I think I felt a small earthquake, which is interesting, because as of today, magnitude 7.1 earthquake hits Japan. Damages and injuries recorded, tsunami alert issued, but then lifted, shopping mall collapsed and trapped multiple people inside. So there's been a lot of seismic activity yesterday and over the last few days in Japan. Japan's prime minister, in a message posted on X, said her government has set up a task force to gather information, assess possible damage, and prepare rescue operations if needed. She later told reporters there have been reports of a number of injuries and damages to road, bridges, and buildings, as well as blackouts and fire, though details are still unclear. There has been alerts issued for their, you know, power generation plants, as well as things like the Sendai and Ginkai nuclear power stations. But everything apparently is okay. We're not getting another Fukushima 2.0, apparently, and so far. We got to spend some more time today on the diary of Anthony Fauci. And I love this picture Rand Paul put up. It's exactly what I picture when I see Anthony Fauci writing in his diary at the end of the day, his rainbow unicorn diary with his Lisa Frank stickers on top. A lot is being uncovered from this little diary. A lot of inconsistencies, a lot of lies. Not that any of it is particularly new to us, but it is very interesting seeing just sort of the way that this played out behind the scenes. You have things like this. From Gateway Pundit, HHS Secretary RFK Jr. reveals Dr. Anthony Fauci suffered a potentially life-threatening condition after taking the COVID shot, but he hid it from the world. And I believe we actually have this. Let's go to clip number two here. This is Robert F. Kennedy on what he found interesting in the Fauci diary reveal. Let's watch.
Is this massive dichotomy between what he was saying privately and what he was simultaneously saying publicly. He says in his diaries on January 30th that the Wuhan lab could not possibly be the source of the virus.
Oh, we know that was all
false. And then, well, we all know it, but now his diary, he says he knew that, and yet for 2 years he told us that that was
the case. But he was given a pardon, prospectively, from the last administration. We don't know if it was an auto pen pardon. It doesn't really matter for legality purposes. But Americans want to know, a lot of them, is there going to be any accountability for trillions of dollars lost, children's education destroyed, and public health reputation, public health industry reputation shattered?
Yeah, and millions of people injured. You know, he lied about masks, he lied about social distancing, he lied about the transmission, he lied about natural immunity, he lied about the capacity, as you just said, of the vaccine to prevent infection. He got vaccinated a very, very public press conference in January of 2020. And then 5 months later, he had, and this is the first time that we knew this from the diary, he had a pulmonary infarction, which is one of the adverse events that NIH, CDC, and FDA said are expected from the vaccine. He never told anybody. He got treated for it privately by the best doctors in America. At the same time, he was telling everybody that that was not an adverse event.
Is there anything else we're missing from these diaries that has not been released that you can share with us tonight?
I don't think, I mean, I have to say a lot of this stuff is in my book, but based upon other documents. But there's something very dramatic, even for me, of seeing him write it in his own journal, confessing to, you know, being wrong, to lying about all this
stuff. Also loving his own press. I mean, they're going on and on. Well, I'm the most.
And again, you know, the thing about him loving his own press is that it informs why he made the decisions that he made. He's not motivated by the truth. He's not motivated by actually helping people. He'll hurt people as long as he can frame it in a way that's beneficial to him. So Fauci suffered a potentially life-threatening condition after taking the COVID shot, had it treated in secret by the best doctors in the world, and then encouraged absolutely everybody else to get the shot as well. You know, this is one of those things where it's like, it's like, how do you even make heads or tails of this? How do you even make heads or tails of this? Because in certain ways, there are assumptions that I had that are kind of being disproven, but it doesn't make anything clear. Like, the assumption that I had was that Anthony Fauci never actually got the injection because he probably knew better. Apparently he didn't. Apparently he actually got. So did he believe what he was saying? How much of what he said did he believe? In the instant that he got sick, like, what is the justification in his mind for continuing to push the shot? Like, it's just not as clear cut as it sort of seems. And then you got to take into account, like, okay, this is from his diary. Did he intend his diary to get out? If he thought one day it would be published, then why would he write basically confessions of lying about everything? Like, his whole thing is confusing. Because on one hand, what he actually did is like a supervillain. Let's look at what a supervillain does. Like, he created this virus and he released it on purpose, and then he force everybody to take the jab, and like, he was a part of all of this, and you would think that this is all a very, you know, sophisticated, planned out operation. And then you see the diary and he's like, he got the shot and he got negative consequences. It's like, well, then what the hell? I don't have an answer. Like, I don't know. I don't get it. Crew's suggesting that, you know, he had to get it off his chest somehow, that he was, so you think he was like driven by some sort of like internal guilt or shame or something, and was bottled up. Guilt being a likely motivator for why he would like confess this stuff, just to like get it off his chest. But then why would he continue to promote it? And it was it really just because that's what he was celebrated for promoting? Because the other thing is that he was upheld to such a degree by the mainstream media. He was always so celebrated and, you know, like he says in his diary, you know, he was like treated as, you know, the representative of science itself. I am the science, remember? So it's not even like he could have said anything. Anything he said was going to be treated as gospel truth. So then what is motivating him to encourage everybody to get the jab if he himself almost dies from the jab? And like, this really is the thing when you're talking about conspiracy theories and stuff. And this is where, I mean, it gets kind of confusing and we don't like it. As human beings, we prefer things to be clear cut. It's not always clear cut, but it doesn't have to be. So, in other words, people want to believe, like the conspiracy theorists want to believe, that it's all completely cynical and the people, you know, pulling the strings know exactly what's going on. That's not always the case. They're not always necessarily motivated by even, you know, ostensibly bad reasons. At the same time, you know, we can pick it out and you can determine for yourself, you know, what Fauci's complicity is and what his reasonings were. Again, I think it's all kind of up for debate. But you can't ignore the fact that he lied. You can't ignore the fact that he covered it up. Like, those things still happened. To then turn around and say, oh, well, but, you know, he believed he was saying it. Kind of, maybe, I don't know, a little bit, I guess, but who cares? He was the one who was pushing the lie. He was the one who was forcing everybody to get locked down. Even if he denies it later, in his diary he admits it. That was another example. And according to, so Fauci claimed he had nothing to do with school closures. Diary shows he was actually very proud to get California and New York to send kids home. School closures during the COVID-19 pandemic were absolutely disastrous for students, parents, and society at large. Students were deprived of their education, social interactions, athletics, and extracurriculars. They were sent home to sit in front of Chromebooks or so-called virtual learning, which was anything but. Dr. Anthony Fauci, COVID advisor to both President Trump and President Biden, was a big reason schools were closed. Publicly, he said, they always come back and say Fauci was responsible for closing schools. I had nothing to do. I mean, let's get down to the facts. Many American children spent the second semester of 2019-2020 school year sitting at home, watching their lives go by from behind windows and computer screens because Fauci urged, quote, caution and school closures. But in 1,141 pages of diary entries that were released this week by Senator Rand Paul ahead of Fauci's testimony before the Senate, it turns out Fauci not only had a hand in school closures, but was proud of it. On March 9, 2020, in his own diary, Fauci wrote, Governor Cuomo calls me up and asks my advice on whether to close schools in the Orthodox Jewish section of Westchester, where they have 90-day something more than the rest of New York. I tell him yes. He asks about closing subways. I tell him not yet, but let us stay tuned. And that's sort of like, this is what I mean, where you just sort of see the behind the scenes, you see the sausage being made. And we already had hints of this. You know, there was the Secretary of State that was, we were looking into her because she was trying to set up basically the 2020 election theft. But one of the things during COVID, she's like, you know, I didn't know what to do. And I would just like call other secretaries of state and be like, oh, you're doing that? Okay, then I'll do that too. None of this was like motivated by scientific inquiry. None of it was actually best practices for, you know, defeating a virus. It was never meant to be. This was all just like the few people at the top of our society just sort of coordinating with each other to see how far they could take it. Like, that, this is a perfect example, right? Anthony Fauci, who clearly is not motivated by what he claims to be motivated by, is clearly capable of lying with a perfectly straight face about life and death situations, truly a exemplar of evil. But this is basically how it works. It's like the mayor calls him and is like, should I shut down these schools? And Fauci's like, yeah, I think you should. And he's like, well, what about subways? And they're like, well, not yet. People aren't ready for that quite yet. This is how the lockdowns were decided. These are how the orders that were given were dictated. Do people know this? Like, when people look back, when their school got shut down, did you think that there was a scientific rationale behind it? Or was it just Fauci's mood that afternoon? Does it matter? Do you care? Do you care if your child's life was taken from them for years on end during their formative years? do you care that it was on a whim of Anthony Fauci because he seems to simply enjoy the act of exerting power? That he's not actually concerned about whether his answer is correct or not. He's not actually weighing the pros and cons and, you know, talking to advisors and, you know, epidemiologists and people discover. No, it was, yeah, I think you should shut down the school. You can? Yeah, I think you should. I think it's a good excuse. The subways? Not yet, but stay tuned. Not yet, but stay tuned. Does he even care? Or is it just, he just get sort of a thrill about the fact that the mayor is coming to him? Please, Mr. Fauci, sir, tell us, do we shut down the schools? And he sits back and gets to exert this authority. I mean, is that what's motivating him? Because that's pathetic. He says, I had a similar call with Ann O'Leary, the COS of Governor Gavin Newsom of California, and said that based on my TV appearances today and yesterday, the governor has decided to close the schools in California as well as the bars and restaurants. He didn't say, don't do that. He didn't say, oh, you misheard me. He didn't issue another speech saying, I'm not saying to close schools. And again, you also get this sense of like distributed, kind of distributed fault, I guess you could say. Distributed fault, where it's like, did Anthony Fauci close the schools? No, not really. But he did give a speech where he said the school should be closed. And then the governors used that speech to inform their own decision to close the schools. But now you go to Anthony Fauci and go, oh, so you closed the schools. And he goes, no, I never did. I may have given a speech to that effect, but I had no power to close any schools. And the governor says, well, I didn't close the schools on my own volition. I was just following the orders from D.C. It's like, well, there weren't any orders from D.C. There was a vaguely worded speech that gave you the justification you needed for it. Following the recommended CDC guidelines, as it were. By March 16th, the New York public school system was closed and students were all sent home. Fauci issued guidelines that he said reflected his push for a more aggressive mitigation 15-day strategy. This encouraged the elderly to self-isolate, for people to not congregate in groups of more than 10, to stay away from bars, restaurants, like all of it. Again, it's all incrementalism. And again, this is what you see. You see the frog boiling in the pot of water. You see, well, don't close subways quite yet. Oh, why? Because they don't transmit there? No, they do. I mean, you know, there's lots of reasons to shut down subways. Just people aren't ready for that yet. So let's inculcate them. Let's get them used to the idea of lockdown a little bit more, and then we'll shut down the subway. It's all arbitrary. It was all just on a whim of Anthony Fauci, or not, or just, you know, he may suggest it, but it's not his fault that it gets implemented. It's government's fault that it gets implemented, but they were just following orders, but the orders were never given. So who do you blame? Who do you punish? I say all of them. My choice would be all of them, actually. Punish all of them. But I bring all of this up in part just to, you know, maybe now's a good time. Here we are 6 years after the event, to remind everybody of just how awful it truly was. Because people genuinely are trying to, like, downplay that. I see posts online being like, yeah, you know, so what? We had to lock down for 2 weeks in 2020 and everybody's like making this big deal out of it. Which again, I mean, you tell me, is everybody retarded? Is everybody insane? Do they not remember? Are they lying? I don't know, man. I honestly, this is just like where I'm at these days, where it's like, I don't know anything about anything. I mean, I know the truth. I know what actually happened. I can't possibly tell you why people believe the things they believe, why they support the things they support, why Democrats don't care about the Anthony Fauci revelations, why they followed them in the first place, who they thought they were helping. And again, in certain ways, like, you can justify lying, beneficial lying. I can even make the case for Anthony Fauci in certain ways. Like, at the beginning of the pandemic, Anthony Fauci said masks don't help. You don't need masks. Masks aren't going to stop you from getting the disease. Then he flip-flopped and said masks were necessary. Later, when asked, why did you say masks weren't necessary? The reality was that, and again, who knows if this is actually a reality, but supposedly the reality is that he was concerned that there would be a shortage if everybody in the world went out to get masks, which means people that actually needed it in the healthcare environment wouldn't have them. So he told people not to get masks so that there would be a supply for the people that actually needed it while the other masks were being made. Whether you think that's justified, whether you think that's an appropriate response, I, for one, think the government should treat its citizens like human beings, not little children. You don't need to trick people. You can just tell them. You can just say, hey, you don't need masks because we need them for healthcare. But then don't flip it around on the other side. Like, don't then suddenly call you, you know, call people science deniers for repeating that exact statement. But you can at least come up with, like, all right, whether you agree with that or not, there's at least a reason why he's claiming that he had to lie, and it seems to be a beneficial one. But this diary reveals there was no reason. Like, what is the reason for concealing the fact that you almost died from the shot, except that you want more people to get the shot? Why would you want people to get a shot that almost killed you and that you only survived because you exclusively have medical attention that other people don't? And at the end of the day, the only conclusion I can come to is, people are all just evil. Like, I'm actually not even really interested in, like, digging down into exactly what it is. I think as a blanket term, in a blanket way, we can just say all of these people need to be punished. They all need to be given the maximum punishment for everything that happened. It should be like a RICO case. And that's how it needs to be sort of developed. But it goes on. According to this DARPA document dated August 13th, 2021, the intelligence agency knew at that time, August 13th, 2021, that COVID came from a lab, that the mRNA vaccines worked, quote, poorly, that ivermectin worked, that hydroxychloroquine worked. DARPA informed the inspector general, and all parties chose to say nothing to the public about any of it. Okay, so this is a segment here. Because of its now known nature, the SARS-CoV-2 illness is readily resolved with early treatment that inhibits the viral replication that spreads the spike proteins around the body, which induce a harmful, overreactive immune response as the body tries to clear the spikes from the ACE2 receptors. Many of the early treatment protocols ignored by the authorities work because they inhibit viral replication or modulate the immune response to the spike proteins, which makes sense within the context of what EcoHealth was creating. Some of these treatments for protocols also inhibit the action of the engineered spike protein. For instance, ivermectin, identified as curative in April 2020, works throughout all phases of illness because it both inhibits viral replication and modulates the immune response. Of note, chloroquine phosphate, hydroxychloroquine, identified April 20th as curative, is identified in the proposal as SARS-CoV inhibitor, as is interferon, identified May 20th as a curative, as curative. So you, yes, yes, you were gaslit. Everybody was gaslit. The thing that I don't understand how we can't get it across to people. I don't understand how people are blind to this reality. But let me just lay it out for you once again. In order to force the vaccines, they needed an emergency approval from the EPA, or from, not the EPA, the whatever it is, CDC, FDA. In order to get that emergency application, there had to be no other curative elements. Like, you had to not have any other way to cure COVID in order to get the vaccine promoted. So they deliberately lied about the cures. So if you're a normie out there, if you're looking at all of this and you're kind of just, we know with absolute certainty that they deliberately hid cures for COVID in order to get the vaccine. Why would they do that? Why would they do that? That's like the question. It's just like, why would they do that? Why would they hide cures? The only possible reason is to get the vaccine. Why did they want you to get the vaccine? You can speculate. I can tell you one answer that doesn't work with the knowledge that we have, and that is because they wanted the vaccine to help people and that it was necessary to cure COVID. Like, that's not a possibility. That's not the case. It didn't stop COVID, didn't stop. So why did they want to push it on you? Why did they want to hide actual cures? Why did they want to let people suffer and die restricted from the medicine? And not just in a subtle way. They didn't just not say what they knew, right? They didn't go, ooh, geez, ivermectin works perfectly. Let's not talk about that anymore. No, they launched a gigantic media attack against the very concept of ivermectin. They ran stories on CNN where they tinted Joe Rogan blue to make him look unhealthy, or green to make him look unhealthy, and claimed that he was eating horse dewormer like a horse. This is an article from 2022. COVID treatments weren't supposed to weren't suppressed. COVID treatments were not suppressed to okay vaccines emergency use. This is the debunking that took place. So people already in 2022 were saying, hey, the authorities are withholding curative treatments for COVID because they want to institute the vaccine. And the media launched an attack claiming the exact opposite, claiming, quote, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine were suppressed as COVID-19 treatments because the vaccines couldn't receive emergency use authorization if such treatments were available. AP assessment, false. There's nothing in federal law or regulation that prohibits a preventative measure such as a vaccine from being authorized for emergency use because a treatment is available. Well, that's just not true. There absolutely is. Why would you need an emergency use authorization if you had a cure already? That doesn't even make sense. Joe Rogan, controversial podcast host, said he tested positive for COVID-19. They make him look super unhealthy and, yeah, claimed he was eating horse dewormer. So, again, I just want to ask you why. What was motivating them? Like, at a certain point, I don't know, man. Do people, they just don't know. They must just not know. In fact, I know they don't know. Because you got to remember, for a vast majority of the American people, their entire view of the world is what is delivered to their phone on the Apple News app. Like, that's it. That's what they understand. So unless there's a headline saying they knew the whole time the vaccines were always unnecessary, like, unless this is all encapsulated in a headline on AP News pushed to people's phones through Apple News, they're never going to know any of this unless you share the links, unless you share the stories, unless you tell them. People aren't going to know this. They must know this.
At last, it's here. Bring it into the docking bay. Stack them all in my chambers at once. I now have all the AquaPure Ultimate Water Filter shower heads from the Alex Jones store.
There's something about this water I feel kind of funny. Hey, do you want to hang out tonight?
These stormtroopers are not warriors. They are vessels. We keep them full of chemicals to keep them under control. Like the dark side itself, it dulls the mind. It fractures the will.
Drink your water, troopers. I am sending you to the desert planet of Tatooine. We must crush the rebel force.
Dude, I think I'm gay. Me too. Let's go back to the ship and cuddle. I thought you'd never ask.
Turn around now and get back out there. These are your orders.
They're turning the frogs gay. Don't let them turn you next. Ha ha ha. You have to admit that Alex Jones is funny.
AlexJonesLive.com. Share the link. Spread the word.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.